you have beautifully outlined the history that we need to know, I think. Now I'd like to get into theology and the more esoteric side of the Shia, because one of the interesting things for someone like me, who's not a specialist of this material, when you start to approach, when you ask the question, when do we first start to see Islamic esotericism, right? Inevitably, in the early century or two, people just almost assume if there's anything esoteric, and by esoteric, I mean things like an engagement with the more esoteric side of Hellenic philosophy and metaphysics, a preoccupation with the batin, which is maybe something we can talk about, that is the esoteric meaning of the Quran. Whenever we see this, even in authors whose sort of allegiance, as it were, to a particular school of thought is unknown, scholars will just say, well, this is early Shia esotericism. It's almost like a standard position. So why is that the case? Is this an accurate picture? Are the Shi'i like the first people who start to explore these more esoteric dimensions of Islam?
That's a really wonderful, another wonderful question. And I really don't know if I can do this question justice.
Maybe no one
in
can.
In a short podcast without producing maybe a two-volume sort of study.
Yeah.
Because you're bound to sort of overlook some nuances. You're bound to sort of skip something, especially when it's a podcast, and you know, not sort of a written exchange of some kind. I will do my best. There is a wonderful study. It's a bit dated now, but nevertheless, the arguments still stand, I think, by Kamil Mustafa al-Shaybi. It was a Cambridge study in which he sort of, which was then also written in Arabic, and it explores the nexus between Shiism and Sufism. Sufism, for your listeners, is the mystical dimension of Islam, as Anne-Marie Chamel wonderfully put it in one of her books. Mm-hmm. She was a highly respected scholar of Sufism, and she would refer to Sufism as the mystical dimension of Islam. So Al-Shaybi, in his book, explores the nexus between Shiism and Sufism. And what he does so well in this, I think, 600-plus page study is to show that the spiritual esoteric teachings, if you like, right? Mm-hmm. The teachings that privilege the interior rather than the exterior of theological dictums, Quranic verses, and other tidbits of teachings. The early sort of the seedings, the groundwork was laid out by a small handful of companions of Ali, a very small select. And of course, for both Shi'is and Sufis, Ali is considered to be the patriarch of the spiritual dimensions of Islam, or the spiritual teachings of Islam.
Right, yeah.
So today, as you know, Sufism is organized into fraternities or orders, if that's a better term. And each order operates as a small movement. Of the tens and tens of Sufi orders today, every single one traces its spiritual lineage back to Ali, except for one order, the Naqshbandi order, right? They trace it back to Abu Bakr, but interestingly, they trace it back to Abu Bakr through the sixth Shia Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq,
exactly,
of the 12 Shias.
Yeah.
So Ali is a ubiquitous figure in Muslim spirituality. So Al-Shaybi notes that those close companions of Ali, like Kumail bin Ziyad, Ammar bin Yasir, and Miqdad, and others, they would respond, again, we're sort of accepting the veracity of the early Muslim sources here, mm-hmm, especially as portrayed by Xi, cultural memory or historical memory, they report that Ali would constantly tell those close companions, ask me before you lose me, right? Because I know the inner secrets of knowledge. I know the trajectories to in the universe. I know the trajectory in the cosmos and so on. He would speak in such sort of elevated or in such profound terms, expressing his deep mystical insights into the hidden realms of the world. It was as if he was inviting his close disciples to explore the hidden dimensions of Islam. And in the mystical memory, in the memory of sort of Ali in mystical literature, both in Shi'i and Sufi, Ali is the bearer of those secrets, right? I've mentioned some names of companions, others, for example, Rashid was another, Al-Hijri was another significant figure. So it was these early figures who sort of believed in that particular reading that Ali had shared with them hidden and mystical secrets of religion that no one else had. And later on, the story goes that these spiritual teachings of Ali, right, were disseminated into an early sort of admirers in Baghdad and in Basra. And it was these early admirers who formed the earliest layers of Sufism. That is in sort of the plainest, simplest explanation I could come up with on the nexus between Sufism and Shi'ism, at least according to this study I refer to, right? So when you think of the early pioneers of Sufism, like Hassan al-Basri, Sufyan al-Thawri, Ma'ruf al-Karhi, and so on, Malik bin Dinar, you know, there's a Basran link somehow there. And then later on, people like Dhul-Nun al-Masri and so on. These early figures were sort of fathoming and sort of imbibing teachings of Ali directly and indirectly vis-a-vis mysticism, right?
Right.
And then later on, that organized into a sort of a clear-cut movement, which we call Sufism or tradition.
Right. Now, the question I ask myself is the historicity of this. And what prompts me to this is like, okay, the idea that Ali and his close companions may have started something a bit more what you might call esoteric in Islam, I have absolutely no problem believing that. In fact, that's a unanimous sort of opinion of all our sources, right? It's where the specifics come in that things become problematic for me. And what inspired me is that our friend and colleague, Salam Rasi, was giving a talk and he presented some sayings of Ali reported by someone where a crowd of people asks him, "Oh, Ali, tell us about the great work." And he gives them this sort of deeply informed by Hellenic alchemy, alchemical exposition of the great work. And it's like, okay, this guy just does not, that feels anachronistic. Yes, Muslims are going to get very interested in alchemy, but not yet. Not in the 7th century. They have to get the sources into Arabic first, right? So we can probably say with a great deal of certainty that Ali may well have been a great imam and a great spiritual teacher, but he probably was not educated in alchemy. The same thing probably goes for astrology, where he is also seen as like the great authority. So the problem I have is I'm reading this book, The Divine Guide in Early Shi'ism, The Sources of Esotericism in Islam.
By Amir Muezzi.
Yeah, Amir Muezzi. And he says, let's look at this. And he's giving this really, really interesting, very, to my mind, Platonizing story of like a Shi'i metaphysics of how God creates the universe through a kind of more emanation style model than a just snaps his fingers and creation model, where there is this divine light that comes from God, which is Muhammadan and also Alid light. And then the Quran comes into it. It's really interesting. And this is the teaching of Ja'far as-Sadiq, according to this author, right? So like still a very, very early thinker in the Islamic tradition. And then he says, here are my sources. And he gives a bunch of books of sayings attributed to Ja'far, which are in the Shi'i tradition. This is like the hadith literature, but not devoted to the prophet, but to a much later thinker. And he doesn't do any critical scrutiny of that literature at all. So in other words, like some of these sayings attributed to Ja'far could be from like the 19th century, as far as we know, you know, until you do that really basic work.
No, so that's a very fair point.
There has to be sifting if you're going to use hadith for any historical
To Amir Muazzi's credit, so just to come back on this issue of Amir Muazzi, he does not necessarily say this is verbatim what Ali said or what Ja'far al-Sadiq said, for example. But that this is at least what is emerging from the medieval cultural and religious memory of the circles of Ja'far al-Sadiq. So when he quotes a book like, for example, Al-Kulayni, Al-Kafi by Al-Kulayni, that is a very early account, right, from the 9th century or so. Now, whether the quote of Ja'far al-Sadiq goes back to the mouth of Ja'far al-Sadiq or not is besides the point. What is established is that these reports are circulating around the 9th century.
Got it, yeah.
Right, and with some sort of, with some laborious historical dating, we can probably date them back to the first century after the death of the Prophet. Now, we may disagree on whether these go back to the sort of the Ali or Ja'far al-Sadiq, but there's a high probability that they do emerge from a very early period. Right. So it's not that these are later sort of fictitious inventions from the 19th century. At the very least, we can date them back to the 9th century, perhaps very late 7th century, very late 8th century. But what we do have established, so for example, take how Ali is remembered. No, you're absolutely right. Speaking from a purely historical point of view, and if we were to assume a historical positivist method here, then it's highly improbable that Ali knew or had knowledge of alchemy. How would that have reached him, given he sort of was in that peninsula, in Mecca and Medina in the 7th century? But of course, from a theological point of view, the point is completely different, because a Sufi would say, yes, but, you know, these figures could have been inspired knowledge, right? Which speaks to a different category of revelation. Now, in Muslim theological speak, the Prophet received revelation. That is where an angel took communication with the Prophet. But Muslim theology, as well as Muslim spirituality, seems to also permit another type of a person receiving some form of divine inspiration. And the person who receives that is known as muhaddith. Right, he has been conversed with by the angels or some spiritual entity. Now, the Shi'i theological accounts believe the Imams or the Ahlul Bayt and Ali was a muhaddith, right? Some accounts, very early accounts, it seems that some Sunnis or some early Muslims believe Umar was a muhaddith, right? For example. So the Sufi memory of Ali is one where they believed he had access to some esoteric knowledge. So we read, for example, in As-Sulami's book, it's sort of called Tabaqat al-Sufiyya. It's like a historical account of the earliest layers of Sufis, where he says Ali seems to possess a unique knowledge other companions lacked. Abu Talib al-Makki repeats the same statement in Qut al-Qulub, where he says Ali seems to have something that others lacked. And it is he and others who quote that Ali was the first to speak of a knowledge that is hidden or interior called ilm al-batin, right? It's interesting that some Orientalists, typical 19th century Orientalist fashion people like Nicholson would say, Sufism is nothing but the hidden esoteric teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, mediated by Ali, right? Yeah. So what I'm trying to sort of bring to the attention of your readers is our job as historians is to assess facts and separate them from fiction. And we deal with material evidence and we deal with literary evidence, right? It is not the job of historians to determine whether Earl or John or Ali or Muhammad or Plato or anyone else receive revelation, because that requires the tools of a theologian.
Yeah.
Right? Our job is simply to say Muhammad believed he received revelation, right? And many around him concurred. as a historian, I cannot invalidate or validate that claim. That is the job of a theologian. And the job of a theologian is first to admit or to invite his or her listeners or readers, do you accept the possibility of a metaphysics? Do you believe there's another realm of existence beyond what we see? If you do, and do you believe, accept the possibility of God, and so on and so forth. So for Shi'is and some Sufis, their view is theological rather than historical. And the theological view is Ali could have access to a hidden realm. He had knowledge of the unseen, as they would say, right?
Yes. And so that, so in other, if I can paraphrase you, tell me if I'm getting this right. As historians, we can say that the belief that Ali is this esoteric sage, along with the legitimate successor, along with a great moral exemplar, along with all these other roles, he is also the master of occult sciences and inner esoteric wisdom. That is certainly a fact of, let's say, the Shi'i movement from the 9th century, probably, we can plausibly say, much earlier as well, regardless of exactly what Ali said and exactly what Ja'far as-Sadiq said at any given time. It's a fact of Shi'ism. Great.
Yep. Historical memory aside, and not just Shi'ism, but also Sunni occultism remembers him as such.
Yeah.
So if you deal with early Sunni occultists as well as late Sunni occultists, so take one of the late Sunni occultists I've written on, someone like Jalal ad-Din al-Dawani, right, who died in the early, very early decades of the 16th century. He was avowedly Sunni in his theology, avowedly Sunni. But when it came down to occultism, he recognized Ali.
There's only one name.
As the most profound authority in all things occult.
Yes. Right? Yes. So, Ahab, in the time we have left to us, there's a concept lurking here. You've mentioned the unseen, you've mentioned the ghaib, and we talked about that as a very important strand in the Quran, which is going to lead to a lot of flowering of esoteric interpretation later on. But there's this other term, batin, and this term is hugely important in Islam generally, but especially, I think, in the Shi'i strands going forward. Can you talk about the history of this term, what it's doing? Because one possible translation into English of batin would simply be esoteric. It could also be occult. There's lots of ways you could translate it, but inner, you know, inner esoteric as opposed to outer exoteric. This is one way of looking at it. So what is the batin in Shia Islam going forward?
I'll give you an example. Muslims believe that the Quran is the word of God. And the apparent meanings are meant to inspire Muslims in a range of sort of everyday activities. It's meant to contain ethical teachings, legal teachings, spiritual teachings, as well as theological teachings. And the job of a pious believer is to read these verses and listen to the interpretations or the exegetical efforts of exegetes who read them, and they apply a hermeneutic that helps them, for example, deal with seemingly contradictory verses and verses which were revealed in chronological order.
Right.
You know, story put short, or to put it in very simple terms, the apparent meaning of the Quran, the outer meaning of the Quran, is what carries the essential message of the revelation. Now, among Shi'i esotericists, the belief is, yes, the outer meaning is important. However, there's a hidden esoteric layer. So, for example, when the Quran says in a chapter that, or in a verse, a series of verses that Muslims read every day in their daily prayers, you know, guide us to the straight path, right? Mm-hmm. For the vast majority of Muslims, the straight path is the path of Islam, the path of God. For esotericists, the straight path is Ali. That needs to be exegeted or hermeneuted away by a person who has access to the hidden realm or the hidden meaning of that particular verse or that particular dictum or teaching. So batin or the esoteric are those who believe that a certain group of Muslims, namely the Ahlul Bayt and others, have keys, ciphers that allows them to unlock hidden meanings in the apparent verses of Revelation. And that seems to be quite early again.
That's really interesting, because it's very clear later on that that is the case within Shi'i Islam. But what I'm interested in is, how early is this? The notion that the imam is the one who can, that there is, first, that there is a batin level to the Quran. Secondly, that there is one guy who can interpret it, and that is the imam. This notion that the imam is the interpreter who can find the batin, in a way, I mean, this is Henri Corbin has said this, and many other interpreters, that in a way leads to a kind of institutional, even mainstream, even normative esotericism within Shia Islam, in the sense that, like, we are all batini because we all follow the imams, and the imams say, especially Ali and Jafar, that there is this esoteric message in the Quran, and it's essential that we follow the words of the imam. So if he's expounding this esoteric message, we all have to listen up, right?
Indeed. One of the many, many sayings that Shi'i esotericists like to repeat, and you'll often find this in the manuals and tracts and treatises, is a saying of Ali, whereby he says, "The Prophet Muhammad taught me 1,000 principles, and each of those principles opens another 1,000 principles to be investigated," right? So that's quite a lot. That's 1,000,000, if I'm not mistaken. And the emphasis here, I suppose, the underlying point being highlighted here by this tradition is Ali gives you that unique access to an esoteric hidden teaching of Muhammad, which Muhammad did not sort of want to share with the multitudes of 7th century Arabia, simply because they were not spiritually predisposed or spiritually prepared to receive them. And it would take sort of many, many years and perhaps decades, if not centuries, later for people to come to understand them. Again, Shia esotericists read saying of the fourth Shia Imam, Ali ibn al-Husayn, the son of al-Husayn, who was killed in Karbala. He had a particular passion for spiritual things. It is said he would supplicate quite a lot. And he left behind, again, if we accept the veracity of these historical claims, he left behind a manual, a psalm of some kind, of prayers and devotional prayers and devotional supplications, which is attributed to him. And he says, the simplest verse in the Quran, the shortest and supposedly the simplest, is one that says, oh, you know, say God is one, he does not beget, and nor is he begotten, and so on. He says, the true meaning of that verse will only be known by the posterity of Muslims, those who come in posterity. So what we see here is a sort of a theme going on, that the early community, vast majority of the early community, hoi polloi, they were not of the intellectual and spiritual caliber that could prepare them to receive these inner secrets. And that's why these had to be hidden and transmitted right in secret and so on.
And so this divides, brings us into a kind of doctrine of ongoing revelation, right? And I know that the
ongoing inspiration, revelation could be a problematic term here.
Ongoing, let's say, development. Yeah, of course, because only, yeah, the prophet in Islam has a very special kind of demarcated position, and he's the one who gets revelation, or the Rasul, the messenger. But let's say an ongoing unfolding of the revelation in time, which isn't done yet. The truths are being excavated and sort of playing out in history in a living process, which is not ended, as opposed to, say, an exoteric reading, which is that we have the Quran, it's done, there is a standard edition, and it's kind of just there. And every Muslim needs to go back to that, and that's it. It tells you what you need to do. And there's no kind of developmental model at all. In fact, in some Sunni schools, they'll even say the gates of ijtihad are closed. The gates of the sort of hermeneutical struggle with what the Quran means are like, we have all the answers, no further need to engage in this kind of hermeneutical activity. That is not the Shiite position, basically.
Well, there's a number of things to unpack here. So I'll start with the very last. Sunni Muslims certainly practice ijtihad until the present, at least among non-Salafi Sunnis. Absolutely.
Of course, you can't read a text without interpreting. It's impossible. It's an impossibility. It's an absurd thing.
So the Shiis would also agree with what your summary. Yeah, so there's a codex. Now, for Shi'i esotericists, and I emphasize, I keep sort of qualifying that, because not all Shi'is are esotericists, right? There is an anti-esotericist movement within Shi'ism.
Okay.
So the Shi'i esotericists are of the view that what they have and others lack is they fall back on those teachings of the Ahlul Bayt that have given them the tools and the know-how on how to unlock, right, through some spiritual hermeneutical engagement, how to unlock or discover or discern the hidden meanings of certain Quranic verses.
Mm.
Not that there's an extra revelation.
Right.
Yeah, there's no extra revelation moment taking place here.
Mm.
Interestingly, of course, that revelation has come to an end is not without some minor disputation or disagreement. Ibn Arabi is an excellent, glaring example.
Mm.
Ibn Arabi is a towering figure in the realm of mystical studies, whether Muslim or non-Muslim mystical studies.
Indeed.
Now, in one of his books, in the preface, I think it's the Fusus al-Hikam, the bezels of gemstones or something to that effect. I think that's a translation usually given to that text.
Yeah.
Now, he says, sort of in the preface explaining how he sort of this book came about, he said that book was simply unveiled to him in a mystical realm. Use a language that echoes the language of revelation. So in some instances, it seems that some quarters of the Muslim spiritual and mystical universe seem to permit the possibility of an ongoing revelation.
It's dangerous talk, though, right? It's a very ambitious spiritual claim in the context of Islam.
From an Orthodox Muslim theological point of view, it's most certainly dangerous.
Yeah.
Yes.
Fascinating. You've laid out the batin really nicely as a concept going forward. So maybe this is a good stopping point for our first episode, which I hope will be the first of many. Ahab Daiwi, thank you so much for coming on the Shweb. We now feel like we have a better idea of who Ali is, how he got to be who he is, the single most important figure in the mnemo history of Islamic esotericism, and a picture of an esoteric hermeneutic, an approach, a way of thinking about revelation and unveiling of revelation that is going to characterize Shia and indeed Islamic esotericism more generally going forward. So thank you for bringing us the source of the wisdom of the batin as well as the concept of batin itself. And until next time, stay esoteric. Or stay batin-y.
Thank you so much.